Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 23rd. This week we bring you an interview with the Irish Jesuit Michael Paul Gallagher, who we met at the Los Angeles Religious Education Conference held just at the end of February. Father Gallagher spoke about his new book, The Human Poetry of Faith, and how to nourish the religious imagination. This is Tim Reedy. I'm here at the LA Religious Ed Conference, Education Conference in Los Angeles, California. And I'm sitting down with Father Michael Paul Gallagher, who's on the Faculty of Theology at the Gregorian University in Rome, a Jesuit priest. Father Gallagher just concluded a talk that I attended on the religious imagination, which we'll get into talking about. But perhaps you could start, Father, by kind of describing your journey. You taught for a long time in English at State University in Dublin, now teaching theology at the Gregorian. Maybe you can talk about the journey you made from one discipline to the other.
Yes, well, as a Jesuit, a certain amount of it had to do with what we used to call holy obedience. I was asked to study literature. I got a scholarship to go to Oxford, and I did a thesis there and so on George Herbert, metaphysical poet, and then I taught in our state university, biggest state university in Ireland, called University College Dublin, for the best part of 22 years. And then I got sent for by the Vatican, and I worked in the Council for Culture for 5 years, and I began in that time in Rome, we're in the early 90s now, to teach in the Gregorian, and I did have a doctorate in theology, so I stayed on. And I kind of make a bridge between my old life of teaching all sorts of poetry, drama, and so on, and what we call fundamental theology, which is really the branch of theology that is most in dialogue with cultural aspects of the world.
Yes, in your talk, you brought up theologians like Hans von Balthasar and Rahner, of course, and Lonergan. And yet you say that you come at them from a different direction because of your training in literature. Maybe you could talk more about that.
Yeah, well, I think I'd have to preface that by saying that they, too, had quite a training in literature. I mean, Balthasar was a student. He wrote 3 volumes on literature before he ever began doing any theology. No, those three, although they would differ on many major questions of theological method and approach, they did agree that the older theology was very dry, very cold, top-heavy, rational, and that we needed to pay much more attention to the poetic, the affective, the aesthetic. They used different words, but they all agreed on retrieval of the imaginative side of ourselves as part of the understanding of faith, as part of the journey of faith.
Now, you mentioned the imaginative part of ourselves. That was really the subject of your talk today. Imagination is a word that's used so often these days, thrown around, but you try to retrieve some of that imagination is not just for artists or poets, that we can use imagination in our daily lives. Maybe you could talk more about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think you'd have to say that it's a word that people can misunderstand. The imaginative is something very creative and positive in us. Imaginary is generally used to mean falsity or fantasy or whatever. So it's a word that can ring positively or negatively depending on how people hear it. What I am talking about is very much in the tradition of John Henry Newman, who used the word imagination. A famous quotation from him is that the heart is reached not through the intellect but through the imagination. And by our more modern thinkers like Paul Ricoeur, the French philosopher, who would say it's through imagination that we become the prophets of our own existence. If you wanted a quick description of imagination from me, I would simply say it is our faculty of possibility. We stand on the threshold of all sorts of new possibilities every day as believers, as human beings, and it's through imagination, which isn't just visual, it's something more complex than simply visual images, that we cross thresholds into actuality, and therefore it's where we shape our possibilities, and there's also a religious dimension of that.
You shared an interesting story in your talk of you're giving a priest retreat here in the States, I believe, where somebody said that they were giving a
a seminar, I guess, to a youth group, and we're using the catechism, and after a couple of weeks, it just wasn't catching on. And you said you need to go back earlier. What ways can how can we use the imagination to kind of lure young people into the faith who might be turned off by kind of the dry dogma?
Yeah, I said to that young priest, start further back, meaning that you have to in some way evoke people's hunger, people's desire, what's deepest for them, the poetry that may be silent within them. And then they'll be more ready for the gospel. I'm forever quoting Shakespeare, Hamlet, the readiness is all. It's kind of a secret of spirituality that when if I can get myself ready to listen to the word of God, then I'm into that space. And imagination is not just a fantasy, a visual fantasy. It's more that threshold, that area within us. Call it intuitive if you want. It's the intuitive pre-rational side of ourselves where we shape ourselves. And, of course, where we are also shaped. I put a certain amount of emphasis that we can be passive, and we can be passive in an undiscerning way before all the rather silly avalanche of images around us.
Yes, and practical ways to do this. You explained when you do a baptism, for example, you may explain in the beginning what some of the symbolism of the, for example, the white garment that the baptized wears. But so you offer a little explanation, but then you let the moment take over and let the symbols speak for themselves, that it's important not to explain too much.
Yes, it's important to understand the richness of the history of, say, the ceremony of infant baptism is a very compressed ceremony that in older days would have taken many months for an adult journey towards the commitment of faith. And so these little moments like the candle or the readings or the white garment, they all have a long, long history, which I think people need to understand. But I was saying that don't interrupt the ceremony. It's like don't interrupt the symphony to explain the shift from a major key to a minor key in music. Don't let the liturgy speak for itself, but make sure that people are aware of the echoes, the richness of what they're doing.
Well, one example of the power of symbols, you mentioned Ash Wednesday, which we just celebrated a few days ago. That is something that continues to draw a lot of people to the liturgy who may not go to Mass or liturgy any other time of year. What is it about the richness of that symbol that draws people?
Well, first of all, that it is a symbol. It's a very visible, concrete symbol. And I suppose it's even the words associated with it. We now have two ways of praying that little moment. One is dost thou art, and unto dust thou wilt return. And the new one, the newer one, is be converted and believe the gospel. I actually, the other day in Southern California, I put the two together. I said to people, remember you are dust and believe the gospel. And because I think people come to something like that, yes, with a sense that there are areas of my life I need to clean up, I need to face, and life doesn't go on forever. One day I will die. That there is that slightly darker side of things that people find in the ceremony of Ash Wednesday, but then they have to realize that Ash Wednesday is also part of this long journey towards the liberation of Easter. So I think they like something concrete, and Catholicism is particularly rich in concrete images of faith. It's incarnational imagination. Or as David Tracy said in a famous book, analogical imagination.
Now, we first made contact with an article I was writing on a New York artist, Alphonse Borichevich, who is an artist working very much in this field, who's inspired by religious imagery, traditional religious imagery, but is still trying to find ways to expand upon earlier traditions. There are other artists out there, whether painters, poets, who you look to, who are kind of carrying on this tradition of kind of religious imagination today?
Yes, some of them are my ex-students from the days of teaching literature. I don't think he's very well known in the States, but someone like Aidan Matthews is an extraordinary poet and dramatist of Catholic imagination in Ireland. He's an amazing speaker, too. And he, he, he has the courage to talk very openly about his own bipolar suffering and how this has put him in touch with fragility and with you are not the origin of your own narrative and so on. And he speaks with an eloquence that I think very, very few people in the world have. He's a very gifted man, and the suffering in some ways enriches that gift. And then I've had other students that have become household names for some people, like the film director Neil Jordan, who I don't imagine Neil is actually terribly much a traditional Catholic, but he has certainly an extraordinary religious, even Christian imagination. Many of his films are about expanding our sympathies, taking us into the realm of a killer, and yet realizing that there's something more than a killer here, or taking us across thresholds of compassion. I'm thinking of The Crying Game, I'm thinking of Breakfast on Pluto, and so on. So he would be a very, I would say, religious imagination, even though his relationship with the official church might be, I don't really know what it is, but it might not be very close.
Do you think it's important for the church to find ways to make a home of some sorts for people like this who may be struggling a bit with their allegiance to the institutional church, but nonetheless have some sort of hunger to express through their imagination, through their art, the spirit in some way?
I don't think I'm at all original if I say that very few real artists are atheists. They may be alienated from what they have found as the rind or the routine of religion, but being an artist is almost automatically being put in touch with something of the long spiritual tradition of humanity. You're beyond the merely materialist consumer world by being an artist. And so that there's an automatic common ground there, which I think the church does in many parts of the world recognize. John Paul, I don't know how many years ago now, probably about 10 or 15, wrote a very eloquent letter to artists, and it was quite obvious that he himself knew something of poetry and drama from inside.
Mm-hmm. Sure, of course, he himself wrote poetry and wrote, in his early days, was a playwright as well. Another one of your students is Jim Sheridan, who's done a number of films that have made it across here to the States. Do you also see some of this imagination at work in his films?
Yes, he's a bit more political than Neil Jordan. But take a film like In America, about a couple who come to America as illegals, in fact, illegal immigrants, in order to overcome the memory of having lost a child. They have two children with them, but another one died. It is a film that moves through a lot of pain and even external difficulty of poverty and so on. It moves towards really miracle and reconciliation. So in that sense, it's a film with a religious wavelength to it, even though it wouldn't be churchy.
One group of people who may find themselves to be spiritual but not religious, to use a commonly used term here, a phrase here in the United States, is young people who may have this hunger for some sort of spiritual life but don't feel drawn to the institution. How would you recommend reaching out to them, perhaps using symbols or imagination?
Well, in one word, patiently and creatively. Patiently means a certain gradualism. Life is short, but it's also long. They have time to find things. Saul Bellow, the famous Chicago novelist, used to say, there are two great awakeners of the spirit from its sleep, love and suffering. They say love can do it, but suffering is sure. That's him, that's not me. And so people won't stay always where they are right now. None of us do, I hope. And so something will happen. But the key thing is, if they are, as it were, spiritual and not religious, to try and help them to have a language for that, have a language that isn't just narcissistic. It's not just me having on a meditation trip for self-relaxation. There's something more to the spirit than just self-relaxation. No, I wouldn't rush them towards prayer. I wouldn't rush them towards sacraments. I wouldn't rush them towards the gospel. they're probably close enough to the gospel without knowing it. But it, in other words, patience is one, and then creativity. Give them instruments of interiority, of listening, of being present, of getting in touch with the heart and the desire and hopes and so on. And wait. The Spirit is, as Karl Rahner always said, don't ever think that you are preaching to a heart where Christ is not present already.
Now, we should mention a few of your books which you've written. One is The Human Poetry of Faith, which is put out by Paulist here in this country. Maybe you can mention some of the other titles for our listeners.
Right. That's a slightly experimental book where I use a lot of literature to talk about various thresholds of life that we can cross. I even have imaginary dialogues between Nietzsche and Saint Therese of Lisieux, and so on. That got put on radio in a few countries, in fact. So that's a kind of a more creative spiritual book. Another one is Clashing Symbols, subtitle Introduction to Faith and Culture. That's a slightly more academic, but not a heavy book. It's on this whole very difficult area of how do we understand culture and discerning the culture around us and so on and so on. And that's Paulist as well. Then I have a short, very short little one recently from Veritas called The Disturbing Freshness of Christ. And that's really a meditation on making sense of faith today. And I take the title from the famous French Jesuit theologian de Lubac, who used to say that in the first century, Christianity came into history as an enormous liberation, a freshness. Imagine a God who could be one of us. But the gospel is also disturbing. It needs to shake our complacency in a certain way. And so I put those two ideas together, the disturbing freshness of Christ and how we needed to start our journey of faith formation with disposition for decision. That's one of my slogans.
Maybe we can end with a phrase that I particularly liked that you used in your presentation today, your definition of faith. Maybe you can just end by giving that to our listeners.
Yes, well, I sometimes tease my students by saying it's the simplest definition they'll ever hear. It's not the most rich, it's not the most deep, but I call faith a yes to a yes. God says yes to us, eternally and in Christ. And we, in our much more unsteady, light on, light off way, we say yes back. So we say yes to a yes. That's faith.
Well, we'll end on that profound statement. Father Michael Paul Gallagher, Jesuit priest at the Gregorian University, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim. Good talking to you.
I want to thank you for joining us for the American Magazine podcast. Reminder that you can now access our podcast by simply going to our homepage, americanmagazine.org, scrolling down, and just hit play. You can also respond to our conversations by going to americanmagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.